Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you and good morning to everyone. We are starting a little bit early, but I think everybody is on the phone line. But if anybody has an objection to the early start, we can put it off for a few minutes.
I'm good. Good morning.
Okay, great. I'll kind of do the roll here, starting with our attorneys. Ms. Hansen, are you here?
I am here, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And Mr. Nelson, are you on the line?
Yes, Your Honor.
And good morning to you. And now, our justices, Justice Miller Lerman, you've already indicated you're here.
Yes, good morning.
Justice Castle.
I'm here, but I'm wondering if NET has started that feed.
Very good question. They have. On says that they have. So.
Very good. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Justice Stacy.
Yes, Chief. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Justice Funk.
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Justice Papik.
I'm here. Good morning.
Very good. Good morning to you and Justice Frydenberg.
And I'm also here.
Very good. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Now, these are the rules that we will try to follow for this teleconference argument. We will give attorneys 5 minutes to make your presentation uninterrupted. There will be no questioning from the court for the first 5 minutes. Then we will take questions from the court, and I will call a random roll of members of the court and ask if they have a question, or they may or may not, and we will go through the entire court. And then if any of the members of the court have a follow-up question they want to ask after everybody has had an opportunity to ask a question, we'll take those. And if there's any time left, then attorneys can use that to close. Appellant has the option always to ask for rebuttal time if you so wish. Does anybody have any questions about that process?
No.
Very good. Appreciate that very much. With that, Ms. Hansen, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Nelson, I represent Reefer Systems in this case. This court has repeatedly stated that attorney's fees in workers' compensation cases are allowable pursuant to statutory authority. As such, to determine if the Court of Appeals properly denied the motion for attorney's fees filed by Mr. Sellers, we must take into account the statutory scheme under which Mr. Sellers requested attorney's fees. In this case, Mr. Sellers sought attorney's fees under Nebraska Revised Statute 48-125-4B. However, to obtain attorney's fees during the appellate process, the applicant must follow Nebraska Court Rule of Appellate Procedure 2-109, subsection F. Reefer Systems does not dispute that it, as the employer, filed an appeal and failed to obtain any reduction in the amount of the award from the trial court. As such, the two issues before this court are whether shall is mandatory in Nebraska Revised Statute 48-125-4, and what is required to show reasonableness to justify an award of attorney's fees. The first issue centers around whether shall is mandatory or discretionary in 125-4B. Under other statutes allowing for attorney's fees, the use of the word shall has been held by this court to be discretionary rather than mandatory. For example, Nebraska Revised Statute Section 25-284-2 states in relevant parts that a court shall award as part of its judgment reasonable attorney's fees against any attorney or party who has brought or defended a civil action that alleges a frivolous claim or defense which a court determines is frivolous or made in bad faith. This court in White versus Kuhat, 286 Nebraska 700, recognized that the attorney fee provision in 25-284 is discretionary. More recently, this court explained that attorney fees under eminent domain proceedings were also discretionary. This court, in examining Nebraska Revised Statute 76-226 in the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline case, in looking at 76-226, which states in relevant part that this court shall award the owner reasonable attorney's fees actually incurred because condemnation in condemnation proceedings. In that case, the evidence was submitted through affidavits of both the landowner and their counsel. This court held that none of the landowners established that they were entitled to attorney's fees, and remanded with direction for the courts who had entered attorney's fees to vacate the award of attorney's fees. Thus, what shall appears in Nebraska Revised Statute 48-125-4B, it is still within the court's discretion to award attorney's fees, and those attorney's fees can only be awarded if reasonableness is proven, which brings us to our second issue. While an affidavit is not always required on a motion for attorney's fees, when seeking attorney's fees at the appellate level, Nebraska Court Rule of Appellate Procedure 2109F requires that a motion must be supported by an affidavit which justifies the amount of the fee sought for services in the appellate court. In Simon versus Precast Haulers, this court said that in making a calculation for attorney's fees, a court should consider and then set forth a list of 10 factors that a court should consider in determining reasonableness. In Fentress versus Weston, just decided 4 months ago, this court upheld an award of attorney's fees, citing to Simons and stating that, although it would have been a better practice for the written order to recite the factors on which it relied, given the recitals at the attorney fees hearing in the case, we find the compensation court did not err when it awarded the full amount of attorney's fees. In Fentress, the attorney seeking the fees showed evidence that the attorney had made at least 5 requests to Weston, participated in motion practice, and attended a hearing. In that case, $2,500 was awarded. Even going back to the 1928 Davis case cited by the petitioner, Mr. Sellers, in this case, in that case, the court called, or there was 2 witnesses who were called who testified to what the legal services were worth and what services were actually performed at the trial in the district court. In this case, we have the affidavit of Attorney Nelson. The affidavit has paragraphs 2 and 3, and the statements in there are not the best evidence to prove the amount of time or the value of his services. Attorney Nelson states that he spent time reviewing the audit of his time on October 9th, 1 day prior to when he signed his affidavit. As he was able to review the billing records to prepare his affidavit, there is no reason the billing records could not have been produced to show the amount spent on the case at the appellate level.
Ms. Nelson, I think your 5 minutes is is about up here, so we are going to move to questions from the court, and I'm going to start with Justice Stacy.
Thank you, Chief. Counsel, did I understand you to concede the issue of whether the term shall in 48-125-4B is discretionary or mandatory?
No, it's my argument that the word shall in 48-125-4B is discretionary following the court's other determinations in cases on different issues where an attorney's fee, where you've interpreted a statute that has said shall, is discretionary.
So you're not suggesting that we ought to revisit that characterization, or that there's something different about 48-125 that makes the term shall mandatory in the workers' compensation context. Is that right?
That is correct.
Thank you. No additional questions, Chief.
Thank you very much, Justice Funk.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Counsel, what is missing from the attorney's affidavit in this case?
Sure. What I think is missing in the attorney's affidavit in this case is that paragraphs 2 and 3, while they set forth bare assertions, I think that in this case, Mr. Nelson should have included billing records or other proof of what he actually spent on the appellate work, as opposed to just making assertions. In the Hutchinson versus Kula case, in that case, the court actually went from $22,000, they had requested $22,000 down to $10,000. And in that case, the affidavit of the counsel included 15 itemized invoices. And this court, the appellate court said that that was sufficient evidence for the court to make a determination to decrease the bills. And I think this is similar to TransCanada also, where there was just not sufficient amount of evidence for what was actually spent on the case. And I think the billing records are the best evidence to show what was actually spent on the appellate level by the attorney in this case.
All right. Thank you. Chief, no additional questions.
Thank you very much, Justice Papik.
Ms. Hansen, your argument that 48-125 gives the court discretion as to whether to award a fee or not. In other contexts, we have said the word shall is mandatory. So what do you understand as the principle that we use by which to determine whether shall is mandatory or discretionary?
I think that was best set forth by this case in DI versus Gibson 291 Nebraska 554, which talks about whether shall should be permissive if the spirit and purpose of the legislation requires a construction to make it permissive. This court stated that no universal test distinguishes mandatory from directory provisions. Broadly, provisions that relate to the essence of the thing to be done are mandatory, while provisions for which compliance is a matter of convenience rather than substance are directory. And I think
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. If we have a case under 48-125 where the employer files an appeal and fails to obtain any reduction in the amount of the award, and the employee seeks a fee, and their attorney submits an affidavit, and this affidavit includes all of the detail that you contend is lacking in this case. In that instance, could the court exercise its discretion and say, I don't think a fee is warranted here, I'm not going to, or we don't think a fee is warranted here, we're not going to award one?
I do believe that the court could exercise its discretion in awarding zero in attorney's fees, making a determination that zero would be a reasonable attorney's fees to be taxed against the employer.
And in what circumstance would zero be a reasonable attorney fee?
I think that the court would need to look at the factors that were set forth both in the Simons case and in the Nebraska ethics rules related to fees. I believe it's 3.105 related to the novelty of the case, how much time has been spent on the case, was it a novel or difficult question? So in this case, we have two questions, which is whether or not the voc rehabilitation loss of earning incapacity report, whether they overcame the rebuttable presumption, and whether or not Mr. Sellers was an odd lot. Those are two issues that are litigated repeatedly in the Nebraska Work Comp Court, so not necessarily novel or difficult. What was the skill provided? Were there any time limitations? What is charged by a reasonable practitioner or other practitioners in that area? And so I think—
Are you suggesting that a case might be so simple, so cut and dried, that the attorney for the employer should spend zero time on it on appeal and receive no compensation? Is that what I understand you to be arguing?
No. What my argument is that every case has to be on a case-by-case determination, and I apologize, I can't remember the site to the case that this court has said that in, but in Simons, you have to look at all of the factors that are set forth, and the courts have made it clear, and the legislature has made it clear, it's always within the discretion of the court as to whether or not to award attorney's fees that are reasonable for a case. And I would leave that to the court's discretion.
Thank you. I have no additional questions, Chief.
Thank you. Justice Frydenberg.
Using the word shall in 48.125, isn't there reasonable reading of that statute to say the statute that the attorney fee is statutorily mandated? And as such, that'd be a policy decision by the legislature?
I think that the word shall, while typically is mandatory in other contexts involving attorney's fees, this court has said that it is discretionary. So I think that it is a fair reading that shall can be discretionary in this context.
If we accept it as a policy decision by the legislature, as a hypothetical, what authority would this court have to frustrate that policy decision?
This court has the inherent ability to regulate the practice of law, and in doing so can make a determination that attorney's fees are discretionary rather than mandatory.
What effect would the case of Black versus Brooks, a 2013 case by us, have on our analysis here?
I apologize. I am not familiar with that case, so I cannot speak on that. However, in the other cases in which this court has said that fees are discretionary, I think that there is clear authority by this court to find that shall is discretionary and can award zero attorney's fees or whatever is reasonable.
Is there any requirement in our court rules when someone's applying for attorney's fees that the client fee agreement be included?
There is not such a requirement that the client fee agreement be included, just that the affidavit must justify the amount of the fee sought for the services in the appellate court.
In a situation such as this, we've never held that the client fee agreement should be included. Is that correct?
That is my understanding in a context like this, yes. If there is a dispute between the attorney and the client as to what fee is awarded, then the court does look at the fee agreement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Frydenberg. Justice Miller-Lerman.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Justice Frydenberg's question, did the Court of Appeals seem to indicate that a contract would be required to meet the statute?
I believe that the Court of Appeals indicated that the affidavit in this case did not rise to the level of St. John in showing the reasonableness of the fee. I did not read their order to say that you had to have the attorney fee agreement.
So their minute entry, you don't think, referred to the existence in terms of a contract?
I believe the focus was on determining the reasonableness of the fee.
I see. And in St. John, there were competing contracts by a sequence of lawyers. Is that right?
Yeah. In St. John, there were contracts, and the court below did not look at the contract between that was in place between the terminated attorney and the client in making its decision.
Right. So your reference to this, to one way to get out of this tension or your competing proposals was to look at the spirit of the act in which the attorney fee provision exists. And we have said that, and I think it's settled that the Workers' Compensation Act is a beneficent act. You've heard that phrase in the workers' comp area, right?
Yes.
So does that inform our reading of shall within the workers' compensation area as distinguished from particular language in other fee areas, for example, TransCanada, where we were looking, I think, at particular language like actually incurred and things of that nature. So we have the words in our current statute under consideration of shall allow reasonable fee. That's what we're focused on. Is that correct?
Yes, we are focused on 48.125.4B,
right,
which says shall allow a reasonable fee. Yes.
Right. Okay. As opposed to some of these other statutory provisions. So if the court were to determine it was mandatory, but the backup and the request was a little too light, would the court be empowered to deny a fee application but without prejudice to resubmission, or is there just one shot at the application?
Well, as I read the court rule 2-109 sub F, either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court could enter an award of attorney's fees. So I don't think, it appears to me upon my reading of it that this court could order an award of attorney's fees despite the fact that the Court of Appeals did not.
I appreciate that comment, but I was trying to get at if the submission was not, did not provide sufficient evidence for reasonable fees, is the proper outcome by court ruling denied and that would be the end of it, or does the court have the authority to deny the application without prejudice such that the lawyer for the employee could resubmit an application at the appellate level?
I believe that there is authority that it could reverse and reopen the record for a submission of new evidence.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Justice Castle.
Counsel, our rule 2-109 sub F does not specify the contents of the affidavit other than to say it must be an affidavit which justifies the amount of the fee sought. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
And so didn't the Court of Appeals seem to rely on the absence of certain particulars which are not expressly required by the rule?
While the rule does not set forth particulars, it says that the affidavit must justify the amount, and this court has ruled in a multitude of cases that there has to be evidence to justify that amount. And in order to justify the amount, the attorney would have to prove the value of the legal services rendered by that attorney related to what happened in the appellate level, the novelty and the difficulty, the skill required, the responsibility, the care and diligence. So everything that is set forth in Simons should be set forth in the affidavit to justify the amount, because this court has said, both in Simons and most recently in Fentress, that we should look at the factors for reasonableness, and I think those factors should have been set forth in the affidavit.
And one last question. Doesn't the affidavit that was tendered here support at least the allowance of a nominal fee?
I believe that it would. I don't believe that paragraph 2 and 3 are the best evidence. If you looked at paragraph 2, where Mr. Nelson wrote that he reviewed an entry on April 18th for reviewing the bill of exceptions and an entry on May 7th for revising the final brief, if you look at those two entries, that is potentially would support a nominal fee in this case.
So the answer was yes.
If you want to take it on its face, however, I believe that that violates the best evidence rule and that the bills should have been submitted because the bills are the best evidence and were available to Attorney Nelson.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you very much. And this is the Chief Justice. I do not have any further questions. So we will go on to Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Ms. Hansen, I represent William Sellers, and it is Mr. Sellers to whom a reasonable attorney fee is due under 48.125.4b by virtue of the fact that we prevailed at the trial court level, an award of permanent and total disability was entered. The defendant appealed but did not obtain a reduction. And the statute is pretty clear that under those circumstances, the Court of Appeals shall award a reasonable attorney fee for such appeal. So we're talking about a very limited circumstance. In fact, 48125D, which was not cited in either of the briefs, talks about how this fee under 48125 is distinct from the amount of the underlying award. In other words, we're not talking about the work done or the fees or the fee agreement for obtaining the award in the first place or settling the case. So it is very different from the St. John versus Gehring Schools case. It is mandatory that some reasonable fee be awarded. We cite to the Sherrard case, which in terms of 48125-5 said that in the context of the interest awarded to the injured worker, shall typically means mandatory. We also cite the Davis versus Lincoln County case, in which this court said that the fee awarded on appeal in our same circumstance is as a matter of a right. Those are work comp cases. I think the cases that Ms. Hansen cites are not work comp cases. So some reasonable fee appears to Mr. Sellers and me to be mandatory. Rule 2109F does talk about justifying something. It talks about justifying the amount. It does not talk about justifying entitlement to any fee. And that, I guess, gets to my own affidavit. And in that affidavit, I set forth that over a period of 20 days, I spent 37.8 hours starting with reviewing the bill of exceptions and ending with revising the appellee's brief. I suggest some hourly rates based on my own experience and my knowledge of rates charged generally. There is no requirement under the statute or the rule for the type of itemization Ms. Hansen is talking about. And I would contrast that with, for example, Nebraska Revised Statutes 25-1804, where in a completely different context, if you were seeking fees against the state of Nebraska, and that includes attorney fees, you do have to include an itemization of the time spent by the attorney. If the legislature or the court had intended that to get fees under 48125-4B, as in our case, you needed to attach an itemization, it certainly could have said that in the statute or in the rule. Now, should I? Apparently, I should have. But I would suggest a couple of things. First of all, it is very clear from the affidavit what I did. I wrote a brief. And the Court of Appeals had that brief. Whether that brief was good enough to justify the fee that you would derive by using the numbers I put in my affidavit is up to the court. Our motion and then our motion for reconsideration were couched in terms of awarding a reasonable fee. We didn't say, please award us $7,560, which is the number you get from the math in the affidavit. We recognized that it's always going to be a judgment call for the court to award a different number than the attorney might be suggesting. That is perhaps why lots of the old cases have attorney fees in very round numbers, $2,500, $5,000, $7,500. Back to the 1921 case we cite, $100. It is important to recognize the difference between the Fentress case, the Simmons case. You could even go back to the old Harmon versus Irby construction case, in which it is important when claiming fees under 48125-4A, as in alpha, for the attorney to break out that I spent 17 hours on the issue that ultimately resulted in the claim for fees, whereas this 42 other hours I spent were on unrelated issues. because that's often the case at the trial court level in the work comp court. The fee is based on one of two or three or four issues, and so it is extremely important in those contexts for counsel and plaintiff to say in an affidavit with attached itemizations what time was spent on which issues, so that the trial court is reviewing.
Mr. Nelson, I think your 5 minutes is up, so we're going to go to questions. And we will go first again to Justice Stacy.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, you directed our attention to subparagraph 5 of 48.125. Are you suggesting that the denial, the Court of Appeals denial of any attorney fee award here also had the effect of depriving the employee of the interest assessment, which is required under 48.125 sub 5?
Yes.
And is that another factor that distinguishes, if you will, the attorney, our analysis of an attorney fee award in the workers' compensation context from our analysis of a statutory entitlement in other contexts?
Yes.
Thank you. Nothing further, Chief.
Thank you very much, Justice Funk.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Nelson, this is a contingency fee agreement. Is that correct?
Correct.
Does that have any impact on our determination of what a reasonable fee is? It seems that the Court of Appeals cited that as a reason not to award a fees, the lack of having that agreement in place or provided to them. Does that have any impact on our determination?
No, because if you ask yourself what fee would be proper for the limited work done on appeal, if the fee agreement between Nelson and Sellers was 1%, or what fee for the limited appellate work would be appropriate if the fee agreement between Sellers and Nelson was 99%, the answer is the same. It's real clear, including in the Kidd versus Winchell's Donut House case, we're not talking about the work done at the trial court level or in the many, many years leading up to a trial. What we're talking about is the limited work done on the appeal. Here's another complicating factor, Your Honor, in that regard. First of all, as I pointed out earlier and just noticed the other day, 48.125.4D, as in Delta, seems to suggest the legislature wanted to make clear we're not mixing appellate issues with underlying trial court issues in this context. And the other thing to remember is that work comp is a strange creature. Mr. Sellers got an award of benefits per week that will last as long as he lives. This award may be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars if, the good Lord willing, Mr. Sellers lives a long life. If Mr. Sellers dies a month from now, the award is worth very little. And so it is important not to mix in the fee agreement for the underlying work with this appellate issue.
Typically, fee agreements will have a percentage for if the case is settled before trial, and then a higher percentage if the case goes to trial, and then a higher percentage yet if the case is appealed. If that were the situation in this matter, would that fee agreement have a bearing on determining reasonableness of the fee and avoiding a windfall to the client or attorney's fees that may be in excess of the fee agreement?
No, because, and, you know, we have to be careful because there are some things that are not in this record, but I would say this, Your Honor, the statute and some of the cases like the Neiman case we cited in our brief say this fee is really for the employee. And it's for the employee because he or she won and then the employer tried to take it away or at a minimum probably delayed paying on the award. And that's, I think, also why it's couched very much in terms of a reasonable fee. It isn't pegged to the specifics of the agreement between client and counsel. I would also just say this, what any given injured worker and his or her attorney decide to do with this extra money is between them. And whether or not that's governed by the fee agreement they signed up 10, 12, 15 years ago, who knows? But that's between them, frankly.
All right, very good. Thank you, Chief. I have no additional questions.
Thank you, Justice Papik.
I have no questions, Chief.
Thank you very much. Justice Frydenberg.
I take it from your argument that you would say that the 48-125-4B is establishing a policy decision by the legislature for employees to allow them recovery when employers appeal their decisions. Is that an accurate statement?
It is, Your Honor. And if I may, you, I think, earlier asked Ms. Hansen a question about the Black versus Brooks case. I also can't tell you what that case says, and I did not look it up on Westlaw while she was talking. I do know this. This court recently issued the Martinez versus CMR Construction and Roofing of Texas case that did cite the Black versus Brooks. And Martinez is worthwhile for a couple reasons. It talks about 48-125 fees not affecting the subject matter of the litigation, again, distinct from work fees, fees agreement below. But it also talks about to deny fees in that situation would shift the cost of litigation onto the prevailing injured worker in a case involving no reasonable controversy. Now, there was at the trial court level here a reasonable controversy, no doubt about that. But I think the policy enunciated by the legislature is at some point the employee won. He's the little guy, and if you want to appeal, great. But if you appeal and you lose, employer, you've got to pay a reasonable fee.
Is your argument strengthened by the fact that 48-125-4B, the legislature did not even require that the reasonable fee be incurred?
And I just want to clarify, did you say incurred?
Yes.
Yes. If by that, Your Honor, you mean that we don't have to show that William Sellers somehow had to pay me to go up and work on the appeal, yes, the simple language of the statute does seem to support that the legislature meant this as not a punishment, but as a sign that the employer ought not have an incentive to just appeal everything to delay payment.
If this court decides that 48-125-4B basically makes a statutorily mandated attorney fee as a policy decision, would that make the appellate court discretion, would that limit the appellate court discretion to simply determining the amount?
Yes, the discretion and the justification under 2-109F is as to amount, not as to whether a reasonable fee must be awarded.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justice Miller-Lerman.
Yes, thank you. Just to follow up on Justice Frydenberg's last question, is this a correct statement of your view that if this court were to determine that under sub B, the fee on appeal is mandatory, and then with due regard to 2-109F, a nominal fee would be permitted based on the record as it stands, this court could offer a remedy without further submissions?
Yes, Your Honor. And on that point, I would also differ with Ms. Hansen in this respect when she talked about, well, there might be some fee based on a couple of things that Nelson said in his affidavit. Again, there's a brief that Mr. Sellers and I submitted, and that is the work product described in my affidavit. And so the Court of Appeals or this court is in a very good position to look at that and say, this brief of whatever quality merits this type of fee. I'm not sure who else would be better able to make that discretionary call.
So the way I hear it is that this court would be authorized to award a nominal fee or a reasonable fee in statutory language for work on appeal. Nothing exotic like occurs at the trial level, right? Something we would be capable to view, like brief writing and motions for reconsideration.
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Justice Castle.
To follow up on the last series of questions, in cases where our review is for abuse of discretion, and I take it you would agree that that's our review, once we get past the question of law about mandatory or discretionary, assuming it's mandatory, we would review the Court of Appeals for abuse of discretion, right?
Yes. After getting past the issue of law, yes.
Yes. And ordinarily, when we find that a trial court abused its discretion, and there is a range within which discretion could have been exercised, wouldn't we ordinarily remand to the court that was vested with that discretion to properly exercise it in the first instance?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so, and that is why I believe in our prayer, in our petition for rehearing, the relief we requested from this court is to reverse and remand or vacate. I'm not exactly sure of the procedural language here, but to send it back to the Court of Appeals for it to enter an award of reasonable attorney fees. And whether that is the province of only the Court of Appeals or both appellate courts, I do not know, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. I have just one question for you. If this court were to award you reasonable fees, what would that amount be?
Mr. Chief Justice, did you ask what amount would that be?
Yes, I did.
The affidavit submitted to the Court of Appeals would, multiplying 37.8 hours by a suggested rate of $200, be $7,560. Again, we did not ask for that specific amount in our motion. We asked for the statutory reasonable fee, but that's the amount that we think was, in fact, justified by our motion and affidavit.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have follow-up questions they would like to ask Mr. Nelson?
No, thank you.
No, thank you.
Okay. I'm taking it that none of you do. No members of the court do. So that, I don't believe we have any time for rebuttal. So that would conclude our arguments on this particular case. Mr. Nelson and Ms. Hansen, I want to thank you very much for participating in this process in this manner. This is new for us, obviously, and new for you. We did a couple of cases yesterday, and we have one more case today, but we appreciate your input very much. And with that, we will recess the court for a few minutes. Mr. Nelson and Ms. Hansen, we're going to get you off the line, and we will recess for a few minutes and get our next case teed up. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.